You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske and Sam Gartner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today I'm talking with Lorenzo Marini about the Data Project. Stay tuned. The Data Project, when I heard about that, I thought, that sounds interesting because we talk about data all the time. And Lorenzo has a really interesting background on that and perspective on that. And I think he comes not from the clinical side, but from a very, very different angle. And we can learn quite a lot from him. So stay tuned for this episode. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to psiweb.org and become a PSI member today. Welcome to a new episode. And today I'm talking with Loris, and he actually sits on the other side of the world for me. How are you doing?
Good, mate. Very good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I actually do have some connections to Australia. I've worked with people in Australia for some time in my previous company, Lilly, and that was always fun. And currently, yeah, we have, you know, in the right time of the year where we are 2 hours closer together. In winter, it's always a challenge. So, but we don't want to talk about time zones. We want to talk about your project. So let's start, but first, a little bit with an introduction of yourself. What's your career has been up to now?
Yeah, I so I've done a few different things. I've started from information engineering. That was, you know, graduate studies at the University of Tor Vergata in Rome, where I essentially studied the engineering of transfer of information between systems. So we looked at mostly they were radio waves based, so either laser based or electromagnetic based. But the idea was, you know, you have a message you want to send. What is the best way to send it across an arbitrary channel? It could be a wire, it could be a wireless channel. So all of the mathematics and the theory to reason about that transfer of information, and obviously start by defining what information is, so that you can devise the best way to transfer it. So I love that. It wasn't my first choice. I wanted to do aeronautics, but with hindsight, if I could go back, I would do exactly the same, because that exposed me a lot to statistics and to mathematics and all the abstract reasoning that it's required for solving any problem. And if you think about LinkedIn, Twitter, these are communication channels as well. There is a model for them. So being able to see, you know, systems in their, based on their essence, is really useful. As at the end of my uni, I joined DLR. I was actually in Germany, in Munich for a small, for the end of a large European project. I joined at the very, in the last 8 months. And it was about maximizing the information transfer in a satellite system. So you had this geostationary beast that was deployed, had been deployed many years back, and had a capability of using many antennas at the same time, each one with a beam. And they didn't want to replace the satellite because it was very expensive, but they wanted to find ways to improve the throughput, so send more without changing the hardware. And so my project was based on theory that had been developed for the last 40 years, deriving all the way from Shannon and the theory of entropy, and make basically simulations to see whether the new systems we wanted to roll out were effective or not. So that was kind of my background. I then moved to Sydney for fun. I ended up shaking cocktails at the Sydney Opera House for a year. It was totally random. Then I found myself doing some machine learning at the University of Sydney, reinforcement learning. And then one day I met this person, Italian as well, which ended up being my PhD advisor, that said, look, I'm new. I'm setting up a team. We want to do quantum photonics. And I'm like, what? This sounds really exciting. So let's go and have a look. And that's how I found myself stuck in a lab measuring single photons for 4 years. And then I stumbled into data science.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of connection to me, actually. I lived most of my university time in Göttingen, right across the DLR in Göttingen. And so, yeah, and was my minor was in physics. I was actually living nearly on the physics campus there. That was directly.
So we can talk about eigenstates.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Awesome. So, and now you have started this data project. Can you tell a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that is one of the many projects that I think have been accelerated by the pandemic. I found myself with a lot of free time and a lot of frustration for how things are in the data space. When I was fresh from uni, fresh from my PhD, I joined a smart tech company. And it was fun because I was treated like literally a ninja. I posted this a few days ago on LinkedIn. And it was very ego pumping. You know, I saw this guy, you know, fresh from PhD, super approachable, that wants to have fun, that knows about data, right? And the expectations were up through the sky. And the reality of the availability of information within the organization was completely different. And so I found myself as a first data hire, tried to explain why I needed some systems and why architecture was important for me to do my job. Just, you know, give me data that I can analyze. And the answer most often was, oh yeah, we got the Elasticsearch instance. Maybe we can clone it and we can give you access to that. And I'm like, yeah. But the Elasticsearch is one of like three or four that I need, and there is no plan here to bring all this data together. Mm-hmm. And I really need all that data together because for the stuff we wanted to do, we needed to correlate metadata, the log system from the app, with data that came from other system software as a service that we were using to identify, classify, cluster, all the fun stuff you want to do. And so I couldn't do it. And I ended up building ad hoc systems and wasting a hell of a lot of time doing manual one-off tasks that didn't fit into a vision, were just isolated sort of heroic efforts instead of being part of a strategy. And so that meant that things were slower. You had to do a lot of convincing while building. And it's really hard because you either convince or you build.
Yes.
Right. And so that was very interesting, though, because I learned a lot. Then I moved to Sendal, where I was looking at the architecture. So different story. They had a data team there with analysts. And I came in as a data engineer to migrate what they had been using for 3-4 years into new systems that could scale. You know, so we leverage systems like cloud native platforms like Snowflake and, you know, the ETL as a service like Fivetran or Stitch Data. So basically trying to use the work that other companies have been doing to avoid reinventing the wheel and focusing on what really was valuable for the business. Then COVID hit and I find myself with heaps of time, and I thought, what the hell, you know? Those conversations we had over a beer after work were really valuable. That was really the thrill of the job, not so much the doing. It was talking to people, extracting them, the understanding how they understood the business. And I was like, I'm going to make a podcast. Sounds crazy, but I just want to give it a shot. I just want to see if this can turn into something more than a hobby. And a couple of months later, I said, maybe I should decide straight on whether this is a hobby or not. And so I decided to establish Data Foundations. I registered the company in September last year, launched the podcast, and pretty much in the last 6 months, I've been head down to let the project start and then go over the initial phase that everybody, you know, the scary part of, oh my God, is it going to die? Is it going to pod fade in 3 episodes? Yeah. But the idea of the data project is to bridge the gap between the business and data practitioners, which is, I think, the fundamental problem that's holding back a lot of data people. So as part of that project is trying to change the way we speak about data and also who we speak to. So the language, the narrative, but also the frequency. And it starts with an introspection, but it expands as, you know, a new learning, relearning the ways we speak.
Data is actually a very interesting word, because who you speak to, it has very, very different meanings. So, for example, when I speak to an end user, yeah, a physician, a scientist, someone in marketing, they understand data as the results that is in a table or the results that you publish in a manuscript. Yes, that's their data. Yeah, the figure, that's data for them. Whereas we think very often in data in terms of, okay, you have the, you know, individual level data and, you know, lots of different data sets, and you need to merge them together, and yes, they may be scattered in different places. And so data for data scientist has more kind of this raw form of things. Do you see that as well?
Absolutely. And so this is the stereotypical iceberg, right? Like you see the tip emerges from the water level. And if you are not a practitioner, you don't see what's underneath the surface because you never had to put your head under the water. It's totally reasonable. And it's also an advantage if we really think about, and I always make a parallel with the evolutionary path that our brains took some point in the past when we started to abstract complex problems and create models in our mind, in our brain, for how the world works. It's an advantage because if every time you need a piece of information, you need to take that deep into the water and see the whole iceberg, you'll freak out, never come out, and things don't happen. So it's good that we can only see the tip, but
yeah,
the other side of the coin is that when people don't understand that it's only a small percentage of the whole picture, we end up with a lot of frustration because they don't understand why is this so complicated. Why don't you just give me that? Give me the bloody data. Like, I just need to make a decision. Why isn't ready? And you try to explain, well, it's because there's so many moving parts, and there's governance, and there's privacy, and there's reliability, and there's, yeah. So yeah. I think we need to do a better job as data practitioners to explain to normal users, normal data users, what's involved.
Yeah, I see that very often. Kind of people see, you know, the role of a statistician as a click the button exercise. Yeah, just give me these proportions. It can't be that hard to tell me how many patients had, you know, this pre-treatment and then that study. And you think like, well, first, we haven't captured the data in exactly the way you wanted. Yeah. You know, we need to kind of wriggle up all these details and see the more exact details. Do you mean kind of whether they actually started the therapy at this time or that time, or whether they needed to be still on therapy, or, you know, and did they have, were they allowed to have another therapy on top or not? And so whenever you go into the details, you always find, oh, there's all these other little things that you haven't thought about before. Do you see that in the same way?
100%. And I think as statisticians, we have one extra challenge compared to people that tend to do more visualization work because, you know, when you build a plot or a dashboard, you can see it, it's tangible. We get it, right? We intuitively look at a dashboard and we understand what the data partition is trying to say. Most of the time, some dashboards are garbage, but most dashboards are okay. So we see that, and we appreciate when someone goes like, well, are you colorblind or not? We need to worry about this for the perception side. Mm-hmm. So these things are easy to grasp. But when you're talking about statistics, that's a totally different story because, you know, people like Daniel Kahneman in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, but many other people have done similar studies. And we know that scientifically, the average human being doesn't get statistics, you know? We know that for a fact. We don't have the brain. The brain hasn't evolved to understand statistics unless you have the mathematical formalism, the formal training. I remember banging against the exam at uni. Theory of random processes, I think, the translation from Italian. Teoria dei fenomeni aleatori. In year two, you had a first exam, 6 months. And year four of engineering, the second exam, same professor. It was such a big exam. I remember, my mom still remembers me screaming, waking up after the exam when I passed it. And the first thing I screamed, I was like, I did it! So it's a lot of effort. It's like a big, big, you know, mountain to move it and to get that ball rolling and start thinking like a statistician. You need to do a lot of effort. So I think we shouldn't be surprised as data practitioners that people don't get it. We should assume that and do something about it, which is the hard part. I don't know if we have time, but there's a story that I like to tell, which is we're building this recommendation system, which really was just a basic ranking algorithm for email campaign performance. You know, you send 100 different click-through rates, different open rates. And we wanted to know what are the top three performance, what are the three worst campaigns. So what I did, I built a very simple system that would infer the probability density function of the observable. So I was basically just looking at a campaign and saying, you know, this one's opened this many times, and then building a histogram from the histogram, extracting the probability density function, which people in the audience will know what it is, but it's really a fingerprint. It tells you what the distribution looks like. And so once you know that, you can say, oh, you are, you know, the 95th percentile, you are in the 5th percentile. Yep. Just explaining this, but not, you don't get it 100%. There's always an estimate confidence interval. So I remember talking to the CTO, trying to explain the confidence interval. And he asked me, is it good or is it bad, this particular campaign? I'm like, it's good with, you know, 87% confidence. And so he looked at me, he's like, so it's good. Yes, it's good with 87% confidence. So is it good or is it bad? I'm like, well, it's good. But with 90, you know, you can't just cut the sentence there. You get for it to have a meaning, you need to bring the initial part of the sentence and the trailing part.
So I was
very fixated on that. You just wanted to know, is it a good or is it bad? So that's an example that I keep in mind to every time I talk to somebody in an executive position, to try not to think like an academic because it gets in the way.
Yeah, I see that in my world also quite a lot. Yeah, you want to be precise. You're trained to be very precise in how you speak. But that's not how usual, you know, non-statisticians talk. Yeah, when we speak about probability, we have a very, very kind of formalistic thinking about it. And that allows us that all the statisticians around the world have the same understanding, yeah, because we all have, you know, the same theory behind it. We all have, you know, read similar books about it, definitions about it. But, you know, when you talk to a non-statistician, well, for them, maybe they know about probability in terms of, oh, if I roll the dice and, you know, there's 1 out of 6 that I get a 6. That's maybe about it. Yeah. And so understanding, okay, how likely is something? And then, you know, if you think about, you have this, now you're having kind of the probability, and then you have an uncertainty around this probability, then people completely kind of stop.
They lose it. They're like, what do you mean uncertainty? Yeah. I'm paying you for your job. Are you not sure?
Yeah. And then you can say, well, I'm that certainly sure. And, you know, there's, we could also talk about some model-based uncertainty on top of that, but then you're completely lost.
It explodes. Yeah, they're like, okay, I need a beer. You keep doing your job. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, let's go back to this data project.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about data management. What is data management for you? Because that's another kind of term that has lots of different meanings.
Yeah. So I see data management as the set of processes, technology, and programs to manage information as an asset.
Mm-hmm.
So it's what you have to do to be able to rely on a piece of data or on an insight. So it involves the architecture, it involves the engineering, it involves the governance aspect as well. And so it's very broad, but the essence is the set of practices that allow you to rely on the digital intangible asset, as opposed to just bank together two Excel sheet and hope for the best.
Okay. So it's basically everything that helps you to get all the data into your analytics system so that you actually can start merging the data and stuff like this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's many different ways. I mean, even just the how to structure the data is a topic that could be, you know, discussed at length for forever. Yeah. But the essence of data management, I think, is to care for the business. The way I pitch it to the business is data management is about caring for relationships, because the whole point of a business is to make up some brands and build some products to deliver or services and deliver some form of value to people that pay for it. And so these are people, and that's what we keep forgetting sometimes, that no matter at what point you inspected the value chain, even if it's inside your company, even if it's between two servers, ultimately, there's always going to be a human being, because otherwise, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
We're here, we're doing stuff for people. So the HR department that hires a new person and they want to onboard them, the sales guy or girl that goes out to meet a new client and they need accurate information to compare the product to their competition, or the CEO that wants to decide, you know, whether it's a good idea to allocate the next $1 million on a SAP system as opposed to an equivalent. Those are all really practical questions, and there are many, many that every business faces in every department. But what I think is crucial in this process of managing and caring for relationships is to look at the business at the level of the data. And again, we're not used to think about that way.
Mm-hmm.
Systems evolved so much in the last 30, even just 20 years. I mean, Snowflake wasn't a thing 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Google, Gmail wasn't a thing, you know, 20 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. Well, I don't remember exactly. But, you know, we're talking about two decades where things exploded from the technology perspective. And so now we have all this flexibility. We can bring new tools anytime at will. Everything is software as a service, so you don't have to commit for too much money. You just trial it. If you like it, you stick to it for 6 months, then inevitably a new tool comes along. It's better. So you decide to try that tool and you migrate into that tool. And every department does the same thing. So we end up with a huge fragmentation of the data layer.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is an immense waste of money ultimately for the company, because it hinders the very principle of any information and communication system, which is information must flow. If it doesn't flow, we have a problem.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting piece in it, because the different systems, you know, the people working on the systems, they primarily have their day-to-day task in it. Yeah, So, for example, they need to just manage their appointments or whatsoever, or they need just to capture their notes, or they just need to get some money from the bank account to the customer and or to the, you know, just get some money rolling. And so every function has a different kind of objective to do something. And for them, the data that they collect throughout is more kind of a byproduct. Yeah?
Yes.
Whereas for the data science people, for the analytics people, and potentially also for, you know, the CEO and the people that higher up that want to make decisions based on that, for them, the data is not a byproduct. For them, that is really, really important. So there is this, you know, competing priorities. And sometimes for some people, it's not even competing. They actually don't see the other side.
100%.
Yeah. All they see is, I use this software for X, Y, and Z. I actually never cared about that. It also collects data.
Yeah.
How do you approach that kind of conflict?
It's an excellent question. I think is ultimately a communication problem. I think we need to spend a lot of time on the storytelling side. Essentially, this is one of the hardest things to do, right? Of all the problems that you can think of that involve people, changing behavior is really, really hard. It takes time. It takes good leadership. It takes management, both leadership and management. And it takes an extraordinary communication and storytelling, because everyone understands in a different way. So the first effort should be, how do we craft a communication style? How do we build a narrative that resonates with everyone? And it's not straightforward, but it isn't impossible either, because we are all human beings and we understand emotions really well. And so I'm a big believer that if we find a way to encode the message that we want to send through this channel by leveraging emotions, most people will understand, not just at the cognitive level, but at the actual level. They will actually get it. They will feel every time they're in front of an Excel spreadsheet and they're copy pasting really quickly, cutting a corner to just get back the email or touch it and go. They will feel, oh, this is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. At least I'm aware. Then if you're forced to do it, it's okay. But at least recognizing that what you're doing is not healthy for you, because a corner that you cut today for you, you know, it's garbage that someone else will have to deal with down the line. And that someone else might be you.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. This narrative always needs to include something, what's in it for you. Yeah, so it's most famous radio station in the world, WIFM, what's in it for me? And this is really important. If the narrative doesn't include that, it will be very, very hard to convince people. And so you need to, one of the things is kind of, you can hear you, it's for the good of the greater good, and you contribute to something. Yeah, so you can approach to the purpose of the people, you know, to hear it's good for our community and it's good for our relationship and its group. You will belong to our group if you do that. Yeah. So that could be a narrative that could be very, very helpful and powerful.
I think so too. I think creating this almost a tribe of people inside the organization that resonates with the idea. You know, I love data is one that I've heard in one of the recent conferences in data management. There was this company, they started printing t-shirts, I love data. So the love was the emotional trigger, but it wasn't just about the t-shirt, right? The t-shirt was the symbol of the vision that the company was trying to communicate. So they had workshops, they had focus groups, they use the internal communication channel for the companies, were the same medium that was used to give updates like this person has been hired, this person moved to a different role. The same channel that everybody received, they used it to tell the stories, they used videos and audio, they rewarded the behavior of people that were showing that they cared about data quality and data governance. And instead of punishing those that didn't, they simply rewarded those that did. And so you find these people that are attracted by, I want to be rewarded too, you know? Tell me what can I do?
Yeah. You want to belong to this group.
Yes.
You want to belong to those that, you know, stand out, and that is much better dynamics than punishing the other way. So we talked now quite a lot about data management. We talked about kind of how we can change behavior. What are the problems, you know? And as you said, it's always about people and people problems. You have now this data project where people can learn more about this.
Yeah, I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. So I think LinkedIn, if you want to get in touch, is the best medium. But the website datafoundations.com.au/thedataproject is the place where every new app is released. I try to add transcripts as well, because I got some feedback that there's people that really don't like listening. They would like reading. So I'm trying to have that backup. But really, it's a best experience with headphones going for a walk, if you can, if it's not too cold. That's my preferred way. But yeah, so datafoundations.com.au is the place. And then it's available on Spotify, Google Podcast, any podcatcher, any app should have it.
Awesome. Yeah, very, very good. And you'll find all these links in the show notes as well. So great. And, you know, we found ourselves on LinkedIn. So if you're not yet on LinkedIn, I can highly encourage you to actually move there. And connect with both of us.
Yes, and if I can share just one single last tip, I learned a lot in the last few months that LinkedIn is actually a very inclusive community, especially after the pandemic. I think something happened in the brains of people. I find a lot of encouragement, a lot of ideas. So give it a shot.
Awesome. Very good. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Alexander. Thanks for having me.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Head over to TheEffectiveStatistician.com to find the links that we are mentioning in this episode, and lots of more content to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.